This episode of Standard Orbit is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org.
This is Walter Koenig, Chekhov from Star Trek, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Risk is our business.
It's like nothing we've dealt with before.
By golly, Jim, I'm beginning to think I can cure a rainy day.
I can't change the laws of physics.
Welcome, everyone, to Standard Orbit, Trek FM's dedicated podcast that covers the original and new cast of Captain Kirk and the Enterprise. I am Zach Moore, and the Chief is not here this week, but I am joined by Midshipman Tony Black. What's up, Tony?
Yeah, it's all good. Thanks, Zach. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, I just elected myself as the Midshipman, so I think that suitably, you know, fits my rank at this point. I'm not Commodore or Chief levels. Yeah.
Tony's a good friend of mine, and he's host of his own podcast, The X-Cast, and he's actually, if you have been listening to Standard Orbit, you would have heard him a few months ago talking about Star Trek Destination Europe.
Yeah, that was a fun event. Yeah. In the same room as the legends themselves, or most of the legends themselves anyway. And yeah, that was great.
Yeah, so his Trek credentials check out, even if he doesn't have the ranks that some of the other hosts
I'm working on it on the network, dude. I'm working on it.
So, you know, Tony and I were talking about what should we talk about this week? And both of our favorite era of Star Trek is the original series films era. That's, you know, from 1979 to 1991. I mean, that's incredible. They came out with 6 films in 12 years, okay? And if you do the math on that, that's pretty good, especially as far as Star Trek films are concerned. Because if you look at the Kelvin timeline, right, the original Star Trek, Star Trek 09, as it has been gone on to be called, was originally supposed to come out in 2008, okay? Christmas 2008. Remember that? Remember the advertisements and the teasers and all that? I was so excited. Oh, man, Star Trek at Christmas. Because there's something about, I don't know, I like when these big genre movies come out at Christmas because it's like the holidays and, I don't know, there's just something about that. Because now Lord of the Rings took it over for a while. I took it over from Star Trek Nemesis, but we won't talk about that. And now Star Wars has kind of planted its flag in December. So I was so excited when Star Trek 09 was going to come out in December 2008. And then it got delayed. And then, okay, well, it all turned out great because I love Star Trek 09. And then it took, you know, them 4 years to come out with Into Darkness because J.J. Abrams was busy making Super 8, which is, you know, a good film, a good modern take on E.T., as I saw it, a love letter to the Spielberg films of the 80s. You know, that's 4 years later. And then it took them 3 years to get Beyond out. Okay, so that's 3 movies. Yeah. And now we're looking at, what, 2018? Or it's got to be 2019 at this point.
Yeah,
if we're lucky. So that is math that I did not do before recording here. that is 11 years of maybe 4 films. And that, come on, guys, crank out the outtake. Now, I know, you know, back in the 80s, it was, see, this is interesting to me. Back when they made the original Star Trek movies, every movie they treated like it was going to be the last movie, right? Because they didn't know. Star Trek, the motion picture, right? Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, had such a definite ending. I mean, they did some reshoots and kind of left things a little more open-ended, right? Star Trek III could have ended there. The human adventure continues, right? Star Trek IV, they get home to get a new Enterprise. Like, every single Star Trek movie could have ended the franchise, right? 5 had, you know, the Final Frontier. That sounds like the final movie. And then, of course, Star Trek VI was truly the final movie. So they were doing it one movie at a time, and they were able to give us 6 movies in 12 years. Incredible. The Kelvin timeline, they're kind of doing it one movie at a time, but they, you know, it's the franchise era that we're in right now. So they're thinking, you know, 2-3 movies ahead. They're planning out all these things, connected universes, comic books, and, you know, video games and all that. Yet they still can't give us more than a movie every 3 years on average at best. So I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's partly because the landscape has changed now. In the as you say, we're in the age of the franchise. Movies cost a lot more to make these days. A lot of the principal players as well in the Star Trek universe, you've got to remember now, are on about four or five different franchises. So, you know, someone like Zoe Saldana is probably booked. You know, she's down for Guardians, Avengers 3 probably. She'll be in Avatar 2, 3, 4, 5, 17, however many he's making. So I think you've got a lot of the cast are all being spread apart. So, and J.J. Abrams obviously involved in Star Wars and goodness knows what else. So I think it's a reality of the world we live in that, and this is no disrespect to the original series crew, but they may have been more available on a quicker basis back then to be able to make these movies, whereas now it takes about 2 or 3 years to even set them up. And then, you know, I think it's the reality of the franchise era and the fact that the Kelvin Timeline movies have got a cast full of stars, really.
That's an excellent point. I mean, back in the 80s, Shatner was doing T.J. Hooker, and I believe that was pretty much the only regular mainstream work. I mean, of course, I think Leonard Nimoy was doing, well, he was doing In Search Of, one of my favorite shows. But, you know, he was doing plays and things like that as well. So that's an excellent point. But, you know, I frame it through that lens because it's hard to maintain the fandom, right? When for the general public, right? When it's like, there's so many franchises, there's so many genre alternatives now in this modern landscape of films and entertainment. Really, you're not sitting there waiting for the next Star Trek movie, waiting for the next breaking news. You know, the general public, we are as Trekkies, we're like, oh man, who's going to be the next, you know, the main guest star in the next Star Trek movie, and what's it going to be about, and all that stuff. You know, we live for that kind of news. But the general public, like Star Trek, at least the Kelvin Timeline films, are not really, you know, on everybody's, you know, top of their queue or their newsfeed, you know what I'm saying? Because you can use, Star Wars is back, right? I mean, the rise of the Star Trek movies came pretty much as Star Wars wrapped up in 1983. So you had, you know, the next four original series movies came out after that, right? So it had this wide berth of, okay, hey, you want to see sci-fi action adventure for the whole family, come see Star Trek, right? I mean, that filled that void. Obviously, it wasn't quite the blockbusters that Star Wars everywhere, but it had a solid audience and a very loyal fan base, obviously.
Yeah.
I think that's without saying for Star Trek. But, you know, when you have a movie coming out every other year, basically, it keeps the fandom alive, keeps them engaged, and, you know, you're like, oh, man, the next one, even if they're self-contained. And that's what's so great. And let's dive into the, I mean, there's not really a term, you know, we don't have a catchy term like the Kelvin Timeline era for these movies. It's basically the original cast movie era, right? That's the best way I know how to describe it. And I think, you know, part of the reason that they're so successful and are my favorites are, you know, they're all so very different, all six movies, right? They're not repetitive of each other. They're each very different takes. I mean, even starting with the motion picture, that's a very high concept sci-fi story told in the trappings of Star Trek, but you know, you go on down the list and they're all very different. I think that's a very much an advantage, because I think a criticism of even the very successful franchises today, like the Marvel Cinematic Universe, is every movie is pretty much the same, especially the origin movies, right? I mean, every movie is Iron Man, but you know, Ant-Man is little Iron Man and Doctor Strange is magic Iron Man, right? Now I love Doctor Strange, for example. It just came out just a few months ago. But it's all the same beats. It's all the same story, that kind of thing. And Marvel has yet to crack the sequel, I feel. I think Captain America, we're going on some tangents here. Again, standard orbit tangents is what we do. I think the Captain America franchise has figured out the sequel, but all the other Marvel movies have yet to really figure it out, in my opinion. I know there are mixed opinions about the Iron Man movies, but anyway, my point is that it's hard to, you know, make movies in a franchise without borrowing from themselves, as we've already seen in the Kelvin Timeline, where Star Trek Into Darkness cannibalizes a lot of things that came from, you know, Star Trek II, and then even Star Trek '09 and Star Trek Nemesis. You can see the same exact themes. The Star Trek and in the Next Generation movies, even look at that, right? You can see, look, here's a villain with a doomsday device that it's going to go off at the end, and Picard has to go fight them one on one at the end of the movie to stop them, right? That's almost every Next Generation movie. So you look back at the original series movies, and they're all very different, and I think that's a huge strength, and it celebrates the episodic nature of Star Trek. While it's the same franchise, you have so many angles you can use these characters and these storytelling techniques that you get a wide berth of an experience of entertainment. So what are your thoughts on that, Tony?
I think part of it goes back to, you know, what you mentioned earlier about how things have changed. And I think it's, you know, when these films were made in the 80s, it was the age of the sequel, you know, and we now live in the age of the franchise, in that you very rarely get a sequel to a movie. You get a franchise movie. So in those days, as you said, you know, each film can function kind of as its own beast. And, you know, there's an argument to be said that two, three, and four in the original films are, you know, a continuing storyline. Well, they are a continuing storyline, but nobody sat down at the start of The Wrath of Khan and planned out the next two films. You know, though, the idea Nick Meyer had was to kill Spock, and then, you know, the rest, he's famous for not loving the idea that he came back in the next film. So it's not something that they used to do. They didn't used to think two or three films ahead. And what it allows, I think, doing things that way actually gives you more freedom in many respects. Because, you know, if you look at the films, at the original series films, The Wrath of Khan, Search for Spock, Voyage Home, they tell a continuing story, but they don't feel like they're, you know, unconnected. They don't feel they don't feel that they were planned originally out as a trilogy, but equally they connect up, and they connect up pretty well, even though they were planned as three individual movies and at very different points. The problem some people have with the franchise these days, and it's good that Star Trek hasn't gone down that route, because it could have become this big connecting, interconnecting franchise, and it hasn't. It's stayed the course, really, in that it's the Kelvin timeline films have got three, you know, different storylines. In this case, they've just got continuing character arcs all the way through, and they play off certain things from the previous films. But the problem to an extent with franchises is that because you're thinking five films ahead, some of these Marvel movies, they struggle to tell the film in the present day. They struggle to tell Iron Man 1 without thinking of Iron Man 3, you know, or that kind of thing. Or it's certainly become a problem now in many people's eyes. Whereas the beauty of the original Star Trek films is that you can sit down and you can watch The Voyage Home, whether you've seen The Search for Spock or The Wrath of Khan recently, and you can have a great time. You don't need... It even gives you a little recap at the start. You know, they know that there is an interconnectivity. They know that there is a thread running through, but they're not beholden to it. They don't have to worry that they plant this seed in, you know, Wrath of Khan that will pay off in the undiscovered country. They don't have to do that. Yet, let's face it, the fact that David dies in The Search for Spock plays into Kirk's, you know, actions and his psychology in the Undiscovered Country beautifully. And it's something that isn't dealt with in films 4 or 5. So they don't have to map something out completely 5 films ahead in order to make it part of a story later. And I think that's one of the great things about the original Star Trek films, in that you can sit down, as I say, and enjoy them independently as they're told individual storylines. And it's one of the reasons I love them. Because to some extent they're both timeless and they're very much of their time. And I think a lot of franchises struggle with that. Not many of them get that feeling.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And, you know, let's dive into it here. We can just kind of go down the list and talk about, you know, the 6 movies of the original series cast. Now, the motion picture, very divisive in fandom. You know, people call it the slow motion picture, the motionless picture. I know it's Ken's favorite Star Trek movie. I rank it better than most people do. I would say it's still better than all the Next Generation movies except for First Contact. And, you know, and it's better than Star Trek 5. We'll get into Star Trek 5 in a few minutes here. But what are your thoughts on the motion picture? Which camp do you fall in, Tony?
Well, I was born in 1982. I'm not going to go into a big, you know, litany of my of my childhood. I was born in an age of... No, I was born in 1982, so the year that Wrath of Khan came out. So I was born after the motion picture came out. And I didn't see it until I was in my teens. Really, it wasn't the first Star Trek movie that I was introduced to. I grew up watching Search for Spock, Voyage Home, Wrath of Khan. And it's a very different film from those. So when I watched it when I was a child in the 90s, it was, yeah, the slow motion picture. It bored me to tears. It really did. I was like, this is not nearly as where's the space battles? You know, where's the where's the fighting? Where's the humor? Which is one of the things I loved about The Voyage Home when I was a kid. But the older I've got, and presumably the more steady, slow, and boring I've gotten, pretentious over the years, I've come to appreciate, and I that's a joke. I've come to appreciate the motion pictures genuinely a very underrated film. I would say it's certainly not the best one, but I would say it's got so many things to recommend it. Principally the score by Jerry Goldsmith, which is my favourite score ever. And I'm a huge film music fan. I have a film music podcast. But that score is my favourite piece of film music ever. I really like the motion picture, and it grows on me with age.
Well, it certainly, speaking of the score, it certainly made its mark on Star Trek history, becoming the Next Generation theme, and of course the theme for most of the Next Generation movies. I mean, when you tell people to hum the Star Trek theme, they probably go, oh, you know, for the original series.
Yeah.
Or they go, da, 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 da.
Yeah.
And they relate that to Next Generation, which makes sense. I mean, it was on for 7 years. It had four movies, much more recent than the motion picture. So the general public, the non-Trekkies out there again, would relate that song to Star Trek The Next Generation. But let's not forget, that's where it all started in 1979. And, yeah, I mean, the motion picture, I mean, you can talk, people have, and we will again talk for hours about the motion picture, I'm sure, here on the network. But it's important to remember that this is the first Star Trek in 10 years. You know, you got to contextualize things. I know my parents are both Trekkies. Is one of the first things they did together was go see Star Trek the motion picture. So, you know, I mean, that was a huge thing of the time. Like, oh, man, they're making a Star Trek movie. I mean, imagine, and this is a much greater scale, right? But imagine or remember how excited everyone was about the Serenity movie, you know, when Firefly was canceled, right? But it's that times like 1,000.
Yeah.
You know, because it's like this cult show, which you thought was gone, which everybody loved, but it's coming back as a movie that's huge, right? And unlike Serenity, the motion picture did, you know, pretty well at the box office. So that ensured, even though the critical reception was not what everyone had wanted, the financials were huge, and which allowed us to get more Star Trek movies on a lesser scale, of course, but still more Star Trek movies. And, you know, the uniforms, right? We got to talk about the uniform. I think that's the one thing people talk about more than anything is the uniforms. I love Captain Kirk's Admiral uniform. I think the two-tone works really well, and it's not a onesie like a lot of the other costumes are. But I also like the variety, you know? I mean, they had a real budget on this movie, and they're not wearing the same shirt all day long. I mean, I'm not – the timeline of motion pictures, what, just like a handful of days?
Mm.
And, you know, they sure change costumes a lot, don't they? Like Kirk – Kirk has his Admiral uniform. He has his captain. He has his blue captain uniform. He has his short sleeve, like, white uniform. You know, Bones has Disco Bones. He has the low V-neck collared one. He's got the white sweater with the turquoise turtleneck under there, right? It's like, man, you guys are like – do you change his clothes that often on your 12-hour shift? You know, I don't know what it is, but, you know, they were showing off the costumes. And I actually, other than the onesies, I actually like most of the costumes in the motion picture. I know that's like, people are like, what are you talking about? This is terrible. But I don't mind them. I think they're very, very futuristic. I know they're very 70s. People say they're very like Logan's Run. And
I think they sit between the two styles that Star Trek was balancing with this film. You know, it wasn't as colourful and as camp and as 60s as the original series, but it wasn't at the point that, you know, and Nick Meyer has a heavy hand in this, heavier than Roddenberry, really, in making the Star Trek universe much more naval and militaristic in many, many respects, making Starfleet much more along that route, at which point the uniforms changed and they became a lot different. But I think it's kind of the bridge between the two. It still has that level of, you know, Roddenberry utopia about it, and which he then brought back really with some of the early Next Generation uniforms, you know, with their very loose kind of, you know, at times, you know, it just very relaxed in some respects uniforms, you know, futuristic uniforms. But I think it's still, you know, in the middle of the, I like them. I think they work well. I think they work well, and I think they fit the aesthetic of a film which is more conceptual than about story, really. And that's the thing with the motion picture, and that's one of the things I like about it more as time goes on, in that there is a story to be told, but it's much more about the big concepts and ideas. And, you know, to an extent, and I wrote an article about this not so long back for Film Inquiry, but I think to an extent the motion picture is the most Star Trek film of all of them in some ways. I think it distills the purest idea of the, you know, the human adventure as it describes itself.
Right, exploring the human condition.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
And going out and exploring the unknown. And V'ger is the unknown. And that's one of the things I love about it.
That's an excellent point, because for a franchise where its catchphrase is to boldly go to seek out new life and new civilizations, there's not a lot of that going on in the Star Trek movies, really. It's about just fighting a villain and stopping a device and all that. Time travel, right? Yeah. Those are all great. But yeah, true is to the mission statement of Star Trek, the motion picture. And you know, and I forget, because I pretty much only watch the director's edition now. But other than, you know, unfortunately, it's not in HD. Let's say there's two things I want before it's all said and done in this world, Tony. It's Deep Space Nine in HD.
Oh, yeah.
And Star Trek the Motion Picture Director's Edition in HD.
Same. Definitely. Yeah. I want Blu-ray. I want Blu-ray DS9. Yeah. And HD Motion Picture. Because it's a beautiful film. It's a beautiful film. It's shot. It's got some amazing cinematography. You know, it's incredible. You know, the sequences and the music that goes along with this is some of my favorite from the score. But the sequence where Spock is going through V'ger is phenomenal. I mean, it to an extent, it's some of it is dated, but a lot of it hasn't. It still has that pure alien strangeness about it, and that sense that you are going through something that is truly unknown.
I know, I love that, and there's a lot of scope to that too. I mean, it's just this whole other world, because your imagination just gets so fired up, because you see like the machine planet down there, you see these orbs and Spock's like, there's whole galaxies in here, and you're like, wow, that's incredible just to wrap your brain around. But I must say, if there's one scene that just epitomizes this movie, it is when Spock is going into the V'ger orifice, as he describes it. That's how I learned what that term was. Like, orifice. Star Trek teaches you so many things, so much vocabulary, right? But he's in this thruster suit and he's moving like a centimeter at a time. It's like, shh, shh, shh. Yeah. And it's like, if anything epitomizes this film and the pace of this film is this scene.
Yeah.
He's literally moving so slow.
It's Snail Spock, yeah, moving through a galaxy-spanning organism. In slow motion.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
My point about the director's cut versus the theatrical cut is I forget which, like, scenes are in which and all that, but one of the greatest lines in the film, I believe, and I don't know if it's in the theatrical cut or not. I know it's in the director's cut, but when Spock says, it knows only that it needs, but like so many of us, it does not know what. I'm like, oh, man, that's so deep. Right? That's like, that speaks to the human condition, the human adventure. Like, why are we here? You know, what do I need? I'm incomplete. What can I find that completes me? And that's V'ger's journey, right? It's finding that completion at the end of the movie. So it's a very satisfying, self-contained film, which is kind of our point here. If Star Trek ended with the motion picture, you wouldn't feel like, oh man, well that, there was no like to be continued if it didn't get fulfilled at the end, right? The human adventure continues, or is just beginning, as the tagline of the motion picture. And you can just imagine the Star Trek crew going boldly, you know, forever, really. And that's what's great. It's like the end of The Next Generation in some degree, right? They're playing poker, you know, sky's the limit. You just pan out, Enterprise flies off. And you're like, wow, that's a very appropriate ending for these characters. That'd be great. So Star Trek 2, right? That's the big one. That's the next one. The Wrath of Khan. I mean, we can't say anything hasn't been said about The Wrath of Khan already. It's great. I love it. Think taking a sequel to an episode, I think, was genius. Harv Bennett sat down and watched them all, as the story goes, and zeroed in on Spacey as one worthy of a sequel. Ricardo de Montalban, obviously incredible actor, and just they really lucked out getting him in the 60s and getting him back in the 80s, right? Because he makes the movie.
Oh, yeah, he does. And he's, with, you know, with his incredibly, you know, buff torso, you know, you wouldn't think he's the age he is in many respects. And this film, I genuinely think, is one of the greatest science fiction films ever made, let alone Star Trek. I think it's perfect. It's as close to a perfect science fiction film, I think, as you can find, really, because everything about this film works, from the set design, from the scripting, to the themes, to the characterization. the story, the you know, even the effects, you know, which are dated to an extent now, but everything about it just, it transforms the Star Trek universe in a way that everything since has kind of followed on from it, really. It, to an extent, the Kelvin films have gone back to the aesthetic of the 60s, which is understandable, but the entire Prime universe, as some people call it, took a cue from the Wrath of Khan, took a cue from the tone, from the scope, from the idea of what Starfleet was and what the character of Kirk was in this. And he's much more of a, you know, very human figure in this. In the motion picture, Kirk is much more, in, to some extent, standoffish in some ways, which is, you could say that same about the film. In this, he's a man grappling with his mortality at the point where he's losing his purpose. And this whole film is about rebirth in the face of death. And of course, obviously, you have Spock dying at the end, which was equivalent to some extent of Vader and Luke. You know, it's that level of shock, and it would have been at that point. Everything about this is wonderful, and it is my favorite Star Trek. Even though Star Trek is full of brilliance and it, all across the board in many respects, but I don't think anything has ever topped The Wrath of Khan for me. I love it to pieces,
and it was so successful. I mean, it's a blueprint for almost the majority of the Next Generation movies and the Kelvin timeline movies moving forward. It's like, yes, I know it worked there. But that doesn't mean you have to do it every time, which is what we're talking about here, right? I mean, if you look at the rest of the original series movies, they didn't like retread the Wrath of Khan. Everything else was new. So credit to them for just like, hey, that was that story. Now let's tell the next story. And you know, Star Trek II, again, it works as a completely self-contained thing. Like, just open-ended enough to make you want sequels, but it could have ended there. Kirk has his sense of rebirth, his new purpose, he has a new family, even though he's lost his best friend. He's, you know, maybe going to rekindle something with an old love, and he definitely has a son now. So, you know, he's lost some of his career family, but reconnected with his real family, which is a theme that gets completely lost once you keep watching the movies, because obviously Carol Marcus is nowhere to be seen. Man, Carol Marcus, what a bad rap, right? She gets in one movie and disappears in two different timelines. Come on, guys. She's a good character. Let's keep her around next time.
It is, she
shows up.
She may come back yet in the Kelvin timeline. You never know. She might come back. But
yeah, you know, I'm sure they don't know either. So we'll see. Alice Eve was great. But, British accent at all. I'm sure that didn't bother you. But
I've got my issues there. But we'll skip over that. But the Wrath of Khan, yeah, it would have been very easy to just, you know, replicate that again. And I think one of the reasons that they're all different is the fact that they all have different creative forces involved. You know, I mean, obviously people like, you know, Harve Bennett are around for several of the films, and Roddenberry was in the background. But I think that there was an element of each director brought their own take on it. You know, Robert Wise with the motion picture, and Roddenberry was more involved in that one, obviously. And then Nick Meyer has his own very specific idea of what the Star Trek story and universe is. And, he, if you listen to the commentaries he does on the Blu-ray, on the various Blu-rays, you know, he's such a laid-back... He's not a Trekkie in some respects. He's much more of a... He's a filmmaker first. And he brings to Star Trek his own view and his aesthetic based on the whole idea of it being very Hornblower, you know, esque.
Well, as he said, he has... right sense of irreverence for the franchise, which is exactly what we needed at that time.
He has that distance but reverence for it, which I think is one of the reasons he made two of the greatest films, because I think sometimes, and we'll get to this, but as proven by The Final Frontier, when you are so involved, you make something that is a little bit indulgent, whereas Meyer made two films, and hopefully we'll find he brings this same aesthetic with what he's done with Discovery soon, but he brings that level of distance, which I think allows him to step back away from the fan service and create something that's truly interesting. Leonard Nimoy does similar, actually, even though he's involved so heavily. You know, when he comes in and directs The Search for Spock and The Voyage Home, he makes two very different films. You know, The Search for Spock is much more of a classic adventure romp in many ways, and then The Voyage Home is more of a lighthearted comedy drama. But he's got his own lighter sense of, I think if any of the films really go back to the 60s and update them, it's those two. And I think the different creatives create a different level and style for each film, really.
I agree with what you're saying. I disagree with your conclusion, though. I would actually say Star Trek V is the most like original series episode of any of the first six movies. You know, but we'll put a pin in that. We'll get to that in a second.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah, okay. We'll come back to that.
What is your favorite Star Trek uniform? Because the uniforms introduced in the Wrath of Khan moving forward here are my favorite of the whole franchise. What about you, Tony?
Yeah, I think so. I think I love the, you know, the fact that they button up and then you can undo them when things get tough and you can have that. They are a proper naval tradition uniform, and I do like the later DS9 into Next Generation film uniforms, because there's a similarity in some respects, I think, in some ways. But I like those, but
the layers, the colors,
definitely. But no, I don't think they ever quite topped what was these ones that were brought in here. They're the most, for me, they're the most iconic, but I know they're not the most iconic in general. The most iconic are the 60s, you know, different coloured, very basic ones. But for me, growing up with these movies, I didn't grow up with the original series. You know, I didn't watch the original series fully until I was an adult. I didn't even watch them as a kid because they didn't put them on as much in the UK. They put on The Next Generation far more. I watched far more of The Next Generation and DS9 growing up as a kid. So the original crew is the movies to me. First time I think of them, as we've been talking about, it's the movies. So the look of the movies and the look of how they dress in these movies is that. And that's what stays with me.
Well, we have similar taste in clothes, Tony, because my favorite two are, of course, this one and the First Contact onwards uniforms from Next Generation movies and Deep Space Nine. So definitely. And they have a lot of that. They truly look like uniforms. You know, it's like, hey, look, everyone looks kind of the same. You have a little bit of color splash and some ranking pips that signify a difference. But other than that, you don't have people running around in like three or four different colors, you know, primary colors on the ship. It just gets a little bit of a color overload, if you will. But anyway, so we're done with talking about clothes and uniforms now because motion picture was a big one. Of course, Wrath of Khan introduced the ones that Starfleet apparently used for like 80 years. Right? So they were obviously a big fan at Starfleet Command. Like, you know what? Don't change the costumes. These are great. The costumes, the uniforms, those are great. And again, you know, a lot of the visual continuity, as you know, as Ken and I have been going back and talking about the origins of Star Trek and a lot of our Standard Orbit discussions here, a lot of the continuity is just based off budget, right? They're like, okay, we got to reuse this, we got to reuse that, we got to redress this set, we still have this model lying around, let's turn it upside down and use it. But because of that, it adds a sense of authenticity to the world, where, you know, in the real world, you know, stuff looks pretty much the same as what we talked about when we talked about the Enterprise ships. Like, a ship from World War II looks pretty much like a ship from today, right? With minor tweaks and whatnot. And so that kind of authenticity, it's awesome, because you look at, like, the Star Wars prequels, right? You get a blank slate and a blank check from George Lucas. Everything looks radically different, right? And it doesn't really fit in the same continuity as the original Star Wars trilogy. And I understand it's like, you know, 30 years before and all that, but still, it's really the technology, the visual style, like, they don't mesh very well.
No.
Again, Nicholas Meyer, right? Artistry thrives on constraint. So when you have limited budgets and, you know, limited time and limited resources, it adds to the tapestry of it all. And, you know, I like that. That's a wrinkle of Star Trek I really enjoyed over the 50-year history, looking at, like, why certain things stayed around and the visual language and all that stayed the same, which, you know, because they just didn't have that much money.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, Star Trek II, a classic, right? But Star Trek III is my favorite of the original series movies. I'm not sure why this became the case. When I was a kid, though, I watched it more than any of them. I think Star Trek II, honestly, is just a little too scary for me. Because definitely the City Alpha 5 eel scene freaked me out every time I went and I hid behind the couch when this came on. Because it's really intense.
Yeah.
That and the end of Conspiracy, the episode of Next Generation where they Picard and Riker blow up Remick.
Yeah.
Like, literally, his head explodes.
Scanner style.
Like, that is...
yeah.
Those are the two most, like, gruesome, like, I can't watch this scenes in Star Trek history for me, especially as a young impressionable child as I was. So that's probably why I didn't revisit Wrath of Khan as much, you know. And then the end is sad with Spock dying, obviously. But Star Trek III, I really do enjoy it more than any of them, because everyone's working as a team, everyone has a role to play. Most of the other movies, especially the first two, like, you had Kirk, Spock, to a lesser degree McCoy, and that was like it. Everybody else was a glorified extra, much like it was in the original series. But as time went on, they realized, you know what, we gotta give these guys, these actors and these characters their due. In Star Trek 3, everybody gets, you know, even if it's just a scene, like Uhura, right? And the whole Mr. Adventure scene with the phaser in the transporter room. Even if it's something like that, they get a little moment, you know? And Star Trek 3 is so fun, right? And it's fun, but it's dark at the same time. I mean, it's not fun like Star Trek 4, but, you know, Kirk's being kind of nonchalant about things. And even though it's a resurrection adventure, Sigil resurrects Spock, it's an adventure nonetheless. They're not necessarily out to go fight some doomsday device. They're out to go resurrect Spock. And on the side, there's a whole Klingon subplot going on, and they intersect when they get to Genesis. But it's not like, you know, it's not the whole standard, here is the villain. He has this device. We must stop it because it will destroy the universe, right? The stakes are large, but they're also very personal in Star Trek 3. And my favorite scene of all of Star Trek movies is stealing the Enterprise.
That's so
in
good.
Star Trek 3. The score, I mean, you talk about the score, right? I mean, Jerry Goldsmith has great scores, but man, I might like James Horner's scores even better for 2 and 3, just because it's crazy that you have such an iconic, amazing score from Jerry Goldsmith, and then the next couple films, you have just an equally amazing score from James Horner. I mean, it's incredible. And he was no one back then. Like, they plucked him, Nicholas Meyer plucked him from, you know, virtual obscurity. I mean, he had a few things under his belt. But you go from a cinematic legend like Goldsmith to Horner, who then became a cinematic legend in his own right as years went on. Amazing. But yeah, the music, everything comes together. The model work, you know, the Enterprise, the Excelsior. I love it. I just love it when you can just see Kirk's determination on his face when the Excelsior captain, who's a jerk, by the way.
Yeah, he is.
very small part, but so effective. You immediately do not like that guy. I don't know if he's got like a nail file or what that thing he's carrying around with him. He's just, man, this guy's a jerk. I don't like him. He's like, Kirk, you do this, you never sit in the captain's chair again. And Kirk's just, you see the determination on his face. He's like, warp speed. And then Enterprise takes off. You're like, yeah! You know, that really gets you like, yeah, stick it to him, Kirk.
True.
Anyway, I love that scene. I love this movie. I think Christopher Lloyd's a great villain. The Greta Prey, all that stuff. All the things that we've talked about so many times on Standard Orbit that influenced Star Trek for years to come in this movie. And then at the end, right? This is really the only time in the movies you get to see a classic Kirk fight. You know, Kirk and Krug on Genesis planet fighting each other, right?
And I think this is what I mean about it feeling a lot more like the 60s TV show. I think this is one of the things about The Search for Spock, and we've got something in common, Zach, because this was the first one I saw when I was a kid, actually, and that's why, even though Wrath of Khan is my favorite, this was the first Star Trek movie I ever watched, and I loved it as a child because it has a real mix of tones, and like you said, it is very, very human, and it has loads of things going on in it as well. You know, you're not only rescuing Spock, but you've got the Enterprise being destroyed, you've got Kirk and the crew becoming renegades, you've got the Klingons, you've got this biblical allegory with Genesis and the rebirth of Spock, you've got the Vulcans at the end, you've got, it's packed full of things, of incident, and at the heart of it you have this crew going off book to rescue someone they love, and it is a really, it is the, you know, the motion picture talks about the human adventure, this is the human adventure really. This is what it's about. This is this crew, this unit, this family that Kirk has rediscovered at the end of Wrath of Khan coming together to bring their boy home, basically. And, you know, to an extent, I can understand the cop-out of, you know, Spock and the argument that it's a cop-out and that they've robbed a franchise in cinema of one of the most devastating, you know, endings ever. But it doesn't rob anything from Wrath of Khan for me. This, you know, the impact of Spock dying at the end of that movie doesn't feel erased by the fact he comes back. It's rare that happens. You know, in a lot of other franchises, that would have felt like a cheat. But in Star Trek, it feels right. And I think that's one of the reasons, another reason why Search for Spock is great in many respects. And I agree. I really like it. I really like it.
Well, guys like us have a different perspective, Tony, because we grew up and they were just all three VHS tapes around the shelf, right? You know, 2, 3, 4, watch them all it's together. True. That was like, oh, well, yeah, Spock comes back. But, I mean, you try to place yourself back then, like, really? They're going to bring Spock back? They're doing that? Like, really? Like, I could totally see why like older fans are still kind of like, oh, they should have just let it be. But, you know, but they went for broke with these movies, and that's what we're talking about here. Like, back then, like, they were doing it one movie at a time. They were doing, like, you know what? We're not going to save anything for three movies down the line. We're gonna blow up the Enterprise. We're going to resurrect Spock. We're going to kill Kirk's son. I'm like, these are big things.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I didn't
that if you were
that.
Planning out methodically. Yeah. Yeah. If you were planning out a franchise, like, in a boardroom like they do now, you know, with a big chart and all that, they wouldn't do any of this stuff. They'd be like, oh, we need to save that for the next one. Like, really? No. Like, put it all on the screen here. And, you know, the scene where David dies, Kirk's reaction, that might be Shatner's best acting moment.
Yeah, that scene is one of the darkest moments in Star Trek as well. I mean, it's surprising, in fact, that in a film that is, like I said, much more tipped on the action-adventure axis, and he's not light and fluffy, like, you know, the Voyage Home in many respects is, but, you know, it's lighter. It's not got that heft and that darkness that The Wrath of Khan has, but then you get this utter gut punch, you know, I mean, quite literally, I suppose, for David, but it's a real shocker. And, you know, when Kirk just falls back in his chair and he goes, you killed my son, we feel it. We're that kind of, what? That doesn't happen. That, you know, it's amazing. It's a really powerful moment. And it's, like you say, yeah, it's beautifully acted by Shatner, because he just gets that complete shock and grief. And it's amazing. And it takes guts to put something like that in. It really does.
David is dead.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, Robin Curtis, I prefer to Christy Alley. What about you?
I don't know. I think I like Kirsty. I do. I think so. Yeah. I think I would have taking nothing away from Robin Curtis, because I think what she brings to Savick is a much deeper level of humanity, actually, that fits this film. I think Robin Curtis oddly fits this film better than Kirsty Alley would have. But then equally, I don't know if Robin Curtis would have fitted Savick in Wrath of Khan. So in a way, I like them both. I'm going to cop out. That's a cop out answer.
I mean, I do not like recasting at all. But, you know, I think I grew up, again, watching three more than any of them. And then since Robin Curtis is Savick in four as well, that kind of adds an extra bit of legitimacy to her, you know. But, again, if you were watching it back in the 80s and you're like, well, they recast Savick, like, she was one of the best parts of Star Trek 2, this new exciting character. And now why don't we get this actress back? Like, I kind of understand why people are like, Robin Curtis already had the cards stacked against her, you know?
Yeah.
And of course, Nimoy had a very different approach. Like, hey, you're pure Vulcan. In Star Trek 2, in the script, you know, as I'm sure all the Trekkies know, Savick is supposed to be half Romulan, and that was something that got deleted. Like, there's actual footage somewhere out there on YouTube, I've seen it, of the deleted scene where Kirk and Spock are talking about how Savick is half Romulan. So that informed Christy Alley's performance. But then when you drop that, you're like, she's just a Vulcan. Why is she crying and acting angry? So anyway, lots of factors. That's just always one of those great Star Trek questions I like to ask everybody. So who's your favorite Savick?
Yeah.
But anyway. So that's Star Trek 3. Again, they resurrect Spock. The family is united, right? We get that great scene at the end where they're all hugging on Mount Salea, and the adventure continues is what we get. And again, the promise of more adventures, theoretically, hypothetically, in the future, right? But you don't have to see them, right? You assume that, like, look, they might get in trouble for all this, but the important thing is they're back together and they have their friend back, and that was the whole point of the movie. So Star Trek could have ended there as well. Could have ended.
I guess it's the equivalent, I suppose, of James Bond will return, isn't it? It's that same level of, there will be more, we're doing more, but we don't, you know, we haven't planned it out yet. Just the adventure will continue. So it's when you look at it like that, it's interesting.
And of course, we get Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, complete departure from, you know, the death and life and death of the last two movies. As Harv Bennett has described it, they wanted just to lighten up a little bit. And who better to bring in Nicholas Meyer? Again, right, the guy who wrote, well, you know, ghost wrote Wrath of Khan and directed it, the creative force behind Wrath of Khan, comes in and writes Star Trek IV with Harv Bennett. Harv Bennett wrote all the 23rd century scenes, and Nicholas Meyer wrote the 20th century scenes, and his comedy really comes through. And this movie is hilarious.
Yeah.
Like, this should not work. This should not work. Like, whenever they do, like, when a franchise does, like, let's do a funny one, or even a TV show, like, let's do a funny episode. It usually does, unless The X-Files, for example,
well,
does it very well.
It's funny you should say that, Zach, because this is the equivalent of taking, and anyone who watches The X-Files will know this reference, but this is the equivalent of taking a Darren Morgan episode and making it an X-Files movie, basically.
Yeah.
That, how would that ever work? But it does for Star Trek. It's brilliant.
Because there's a certain expectation by people who aren't, you know, uber fans of what Star Trek or the X-Files is, and then you show them something like that, like, whoa, what is this? But this Voyage Home, this totally worked. It connected with the non-Trekkie audience in a huge way, and it's everyone still knows, quote-unquote, the one with the whales, yeah. Right? Everyone knows it. And it's hilarious, like the Spock using profanity. Like, I love he's
the hell I can't.
When he gets out of the pool, and Gillian Taylor's like, what are you in there talking to my whales? And he's like, they like you very much, but they are not the hell, your whales. The colorful metaphors, I love it. And it holds up so well. I think, and you said it best earlier, and you said they're timeless, but they are so of their time. Because this movie is so 80s, and it embraces the fact that it's the 80s. The comedy is so timeless because you know these characters and you love these characters, and it's not just comedy for comedy's sake. Like, it's playing into how these characters would truly react. Like Scotty in the computer,
yeah.
Right? So funny. Hello, computer. Like, everybody does that. Like, at the computer lab in school, you pick up the mouse, you talk to the computer, like, ah ha ha, look, I'm Scotty, right? It's great. And the movie shouldn't work, but it totally does.
It's remarkable, really. And I think get what you got to the point there, really, in that. Yeah, okay. The 80s aesthetics of this, you know, 80s San Francisco is brilliantly 80s now. You know, with the jazz, the sax on the soundtrack, and you know, the perm hairdos, and you know, the punk guy who is on the bus, and it's wonderful to look back. It is like a little time capsule. But the fact that they're from the future and they're from a fictional future is part of the, and that being part of the joke, in that they're completely out of time, and they are, you know, they're making jokes that can, that you could port them into this time, and they could make the same kind of jokes in a way. They're not jokes about the 80s. They're not jokes that are time specific. The comedy is about their interactions with that time. It's about their confusion about that time, and the fact they're all the things we take for granted. And, you know, the basics are still there. The fact we use money, and the fact that we, you know, we have newspapers, you know, in things. And the technology's changed, but the essence is the same. They are completely baffled by
it. What does it mean, exact change?
Exact change. Exactly. You know, we still have exact change. And you can still laugh at these jokes because they still apply in a world that's 30 years later. And that's the beauty of it, and the fact that it's just such a sweet movie. It's got such a really great message as well, in that it is all about conservation and environmentalism, and yeah, okay, it's a little on the nose about it, I guess, and you know, Leonard Nimoy intentionally wanted the film to be about this. You know, he made no bones about that. He wanted to make a film warning about the dangers of, you know, conservationism, but. You know, and killing our nature and natural species. But I think that it's just such a warm movie, and it's such a kind movie, and a movie with such a good message and a good heart, that even though it's bonkers, because it really is crazy, it's one of those things that I think you'd have to be quite hard of heart not to take some joy in it. And much as The Wrath of Khan is the best Star Trek movie, and I love it, I kind of think The Voyage Home is my favourite for this, for the fact that I can put it on, and every single time I will laugh, I will smile, it's just like a blanket. And yeah, it's a beautiful film.
Well, yeah, same for me. Like, when you rank the Star Trek movies, like, if I could put 2, 3, and 4 on the same space, I would. Like, 2, 3, and 4, this trilogy, the Genesis trilogy, it has become known as, that's my favorite of anything Star Trek. Like, that is Star Trek to me, these three movies here. And then Star Trek VI is like a nice epilogue to this, due to all the thematic connections and, you know, behind-the-scenes connections as well. And no villain in Star Trek IV. No real violence of any kind. You know, I mean, that shows you that you don't have to do the cliche blueprint from... that's become cliche from The Wrath of Khan for every movie, right? I mean, again, they're trying new things. They're doing risky things, because Leonard Nimoy, above all, he was an artist, right? And he wanted to try different things. Artists get tired of doing the same thing over and over and over. That's why when he came back to Star Trek, he always wanted to make sure there was something new for his character and for the story. Because if he's just showing up for a quick paycheck, you know, then it's not worth his time, and it's a disservice to Star Trek and to his character. So, yeah, all credit to these guys. For Star Trek. For now, Star Trek 5, talking about taking a risk. another film without a true villain, because Cybok, yes, he's an antagonist, but yeah. He has no violent intentions, no. You know? So I think Cybok is actually a fascinating character. I like that he has a different agenda, and that's why I feel like Star Trek 5, as we referenced earlier, is the most like an original series show. A zealot takes over the Enterprise and takes him to the center of the universe to meet God. I mean, that's pretty much like a wacky third season TOS episode, right?
It is, I guess,
or an episode of the animated series where they do go to the center of the universe, center of the galaxy here. I know, before you correct me, everyone, I know they go to the center of the galaxy, not the universe. This is a polarizing film. I like it more than most people seem to. Yes, the special effects are bad, okay? I'll give you that. And it's not as good as all the other TOS movies. But still, it's a fun Star Trek movie. Because it comes down to Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, their interactions. They are the heart of this movie. This has the best Kirk, Spock, and McCoy movies of moments of all the movies. By this point, they've been playing the characters for almost 25 years. Shatner, Nimoy, and Kelly are just old friends, and it's so natural to them. And I love watching them in this movie. I love them on shore leave. Like, I love seeing, you know, it's similar to the fish out of water like Star Trek IV, just out off the ship doing things, you know. Kirk climbing, you know, and Spock having to save him. It's just funny. And McCoy just, like, freaking out about it. Like, that is their relationship in a nutshell, right? And that continues on through the whole movie. So I like it more than most. I understand why people don't. Where do you stand on Star Trek V?
Well, I can't disagree with what you've said there. I think the interaction between those three is great. And their interactions are what keep this going in many respects. I think that it's got some merit. I mean, again, it's got a great score by Jerry Goldsmith. Another, not as good as the motion picture, but it's got some beautiful tracks in it, some beautiful moments in terms of the music. I agree that Cybok is a fascinating character. He is a controversial character for the fact of the lineage connection to Spock, which I think to some extent is apocryphal, isn't it? Or I think a lot of people consider it a little bit apocryphal. But, I mean, I wish he'd have been played by Sean Connery as well, which I believe they were going after for the role. I think
the planet Shakari.
Shakari, yeah, exactly, yeah. So I think that...
although that would have been too distracting, though,
well,
I think.
I guess it would, but I think he would have brought a real... I mean, Lawrence Luckenbill was good, don't get me wrong, but I think Connery would have really brought, A, some star power, and also a real level of mysticism to this. But, you know, as usual, Connery doesn't do roles he doesn't understand. Like, that's why he turned Gandalf down. Things that are mystical just confuse the hell out of him, and he's like, what the hell is all this?
I didn't understand it. Yeah. Gandalf the Grey.
What does it mean? He wouldn't have got it all. But
fly, you fools.
But I think he would have brought something else to Cybok. Cybok is interesting because, like you said, he's a zealot. And I think what I love about... I do love this about Final Frontier, even though I don't like the whole film as a whole. And I think it's probably the weakest of all six. Well, it is the weakest of all six. But I think what I like about it is the whole idea of the pain aspect and relieving someone of their pain and taking that away. And that great moment when Kirk says, no, you know, I need my pain. You know, my pain is what makes me who I am. It's what makes me human. You know, when Bones has it taken away and he's a different man, you know, he has that it is that level of, it applies a level of, you know, as in magic circles, glamour. You know, when you take away that pain, it's almost like they become his acolytes. They become this, you know, this empty vessel. But Kirk recognizes that he needs it. He needs that pain. And I think I love that mystical element to it. There is the Final Frontier, and ultimately I know God turns out to be, you know, a big con. You know, what does God need with a starship? All that stuff.
So quotable, right?
Yeah, it's a great line. It's a great line, definitely. It has a level of mysticism to it, which is rare for the Star Trek universe. But then is it? Because to an extent, if you think about it, quite a lot of these original Star Trek movies have certain biblical or mystical elements to them. You know, certainly the whole Genesis idea is, you know, it's a parable in many respects. And this is a, for a film that is all about science, in many respects, The Final Frontier is a quite a religious movie and has a lot of religious undertones going through it. And it's fascinating in that respect. But I just think I think Shatner's lack of directorial ability gets in the way to an extent. And I think, I think it's just got its problems. It's a bit creaky, but the ideas are there. It just doesn't all come together.
Yeah, the execution is lacking, but the conceptually, I think it's pretty strong. And, of course, there were lots of the writer strikes and budget cuts and all kinds of you know, there literally is a book they wrote about this, about the behind the scenes making of Star Trek V. So interesting concepts that could have made for a stronger film. Although, yeah, to your point there about the whole pain scene, that's one of the best scenes in Star Trek, you know, with McCoy and his father. And then, that, you know, there are a couple of quotes in Star Trek that are like life lessons that like I take with me and hold with me every day. One would be in Tapestry, where at the end where Picard's talking about how, you know, if you go back and you start changing things, it unravels the tapestry of your life, you know, and things have to be the way they had to be. And then also here in Star Trek V, where Kirk's like, I don't want my pain taken away. I need my pain. You know, that's something. It's the things we carry with us. It's the things that make us who we are. Like,
and that's great. And
that is deep character stuff. And that is the human condition. That is what Star Trek is doing. It's, we have this crazy fantasy story going on, but through, you know, you focus it down, it's talking about pain and loss and living with that pain, and that's part of life. And heavy stuff for a movie that people just write off as, oh yeah, the one Shatner directed, that was stupid.
Yeah, and that's unfair.
So that's five, and, you know, after five, they had, there was some indecision about where to go. You know, they even talked about rebooting everything, you know, as they did now, Harv Bennett's classic Star Trek, the Academy years, and movie and all that, with young, like, Ethan Hawke and John Cusack, and these were suggested actors to take over for Shatner and Nimoy. But instead, you know, Nimoy and Meyer got together and came up with The Undiscovered Country, Star Trek VI, which is also in contention for one of the best Star Trek movies.
Yeah.
As well. Now, this is actually Star Trek VI. I don't remember the whole thing. This is the first movie I remember seeing at the theater.
Yep, same.
But I only remember... really? Okay.
Yep, same.
Now, do you remember the whole thing? Because all I remember is the end credits. Like, I just remember, like, my dad, like, picking me up and, like, watching all the signatures at the end, and then we left at the end of the credits, and that's what I remember. For that, I don't know if I fell asleep, you know, I was a small kid at the time, so I don't know, but this is the first film I remember seeing in the theater. So and then I remember when it was like first broadcast on TV, it was a big deal, and the VHS had the special home video version with a few extra minutes. It had Odo, General Odo, in there. Rene Auberjonois was in there as a colonel, Colonel West. So but anyway, all the personal anecdotes aside, this is a great film. Right, and it's rightly up there with 2, 3, and 4 as the best Star Trek movies. Tony, what about you? What do you think?
Oh, completely. Yeah, I mean, again, the fact that I saw it at the cinema for the first time, the first Star Trek movie I ever saw, does color that to an extent. You know, I remember more of it than you. I mean, I was 9 at the time, so I remember a little bit more of it than you. But it's regardless of that, it's great. It's Nick Meyer again, obviously coming back, bringing his own stamp on things. It has a lot of connective tissue to The Wrath of Khan and The Search for Spock, thematically and in terms of tone. And it's a great parallel for... And this ties into, to an extent, to the 60s series in many respects as well, because it does allegorize and parallel the end of the Cold War. You know, it came out the year the Berlin Wall came down. So the whole basis of it and the thesis of it is that it's paralleling the end. You know, the Klingons and Rurapenthe is the... Not Rurapenthe, Praxis, the moon that blew up. My mistake. It parallels the fall of the Soviet Union. Praxis, in many respects, is Chernobyl. You know, in many ways, it has that... There's a lot of that, you know, allegory going on, which is one of the things that Star Trek's so good at. And it plays with that idea of a once great empire crumbling due to all kinds of different concerns, and then, you know, people exploiting that with obviously the ultimate conspiracy and everything that goes on. It's a different film to The Wrath of Khan. It's, in many respects, it's much more of an investigative mystery. You know, Spock spends most of it playing Columbo, really. But it works really well for that, and it brings, you know, Shatner brought a lot more of the color and camp back into it, while Nimoy brought a lot more of the heart and soul. What Meyer does, he keeps that heart, but he brings it much more down to a gritty sense of Earth, and he injects much more of that power and that level of, you know, naval authority into it again. And I think what he creates is a really fitting send off for a cast who, by this point, you know, it's fitting. I think that the last film really just set them up with a challenge. It's not an easy breeze in some respects. The Final Frontier, you could have ended it there, but I think it would have been a little bit too easy. I like the fact that the final film, they have a fight on their hands, and it's good. It's good in that respect.
This is a perfect conclusion to the original series, calling back to the whole, well, Russia was the Klingon Empire back in the 60s, and so we're calling that back, current events. You know, I guess my only thing would be, yes, we were younger at the time, but they were still current enough events, so we kind of knew what was going on, and, you know, that was the hot topic at, you know, school and whatnot, political science, whatever you want to call it. Do you think the metaphors here are going to be lost on future generations, Tony? Because it's so A to B, Russia, Klingons, United States, Starfleet. Will that be lost on people who really have no concept of what even the Cold War was?
It's a good question, actually. Maybe. I mean, it's that whole thing of that, you know, there is a sense right now, and this is why we need Star Trek back more than ever, you know, pure Star Trek in exploring the human condition and the world, in that I feel like we're in an area of you know, the human condition now and the human adventure that is forgetting history. And we are starting to forget some of the key, you know, constants of our past and the important moments, you know, like, and, you know, the fall of the Soviet Union was, you know, the really next big thing after the end of the Second World War. And Star Trek was born out of the, you know, the hope and the, you know, the colour that came out of that, you know, one of the darkest periods of our entire, you know, history. You know, Star Trek came out of that as a beacon of hope and trying to explore, you know, and look towards a brighter future. And The Undiscovered Country taps into that level of, you know, that hope that's still there. We've got older, you know, things have changed, people have moved on, the world is starting to change. But that sense of hope when the war came down, and in this case, the possibility of peace with the Klingons after, you know, a level of, conflict. And that final, you know, that final sequence where Kirk saves Azitbur, and she says, you know, you've restored my father's faith. And he says, well, you've restored my son's. It's a personal thing for Kirk, but it's a bigger idea of these former enemies coming together, which now we've got away from. And we're getting to a point now where these old conflicts don't seem to matter anymore as we head potentially towards new ones, unfortunately. So yeah, maybe it will be, or maybe it will be seen as something important, as this whole first phase of Star Trek will be seen with the original crew and the very first Kirk and Spock and co, as reflective of a time where we were thinking more about our past as we go forward. So I'd like to think in a way that The Undiscovered Country will be even more important as time goes on and we reflect back on some of the mistakes we're making right now, I think. That's quite deep. Sorry, that is pretty deep. But
now, how do I follow that up? I will say that, you know, I think it's important when we talk about these social issues in Star Trek that the films are not pretentious, and they're not. Star Trek IV,
oh, no.
The comedy film, if there ever was one, talking about, you know, conservation, you know, wildlife, caring about the planet, right? A political social issue, but couched in a very entertaining story where you don't feel like you're being preached to. And much in the same way, Star Trek VI, right? It's talking about all the things you just said. I won't even paraphrase you because you said it so well. But all those things, but told in a engaging story, a thriller, you know, with some comedy. I mean, there's some great comedy here where Scotty's like, we're dead. Spock says, I've been dead before. Like, that's brilliant. That's brilliant. Would Spock say that? I don't know, but I think it's hilarious.
I think he would. All the stuff as well with Kirk and Bones on Ruripenthe. There's some comedy there as well with what's her name? The shape change.
Martia.
Yeah. There's some good comedy there too.
I can't believe I kissed you. It must have been your lifelong ambition. Yeah. So the beginning of Shatner's self-awareness, which he has become so famous for and it used to great success in the latter stages of his career.
Yeah.
So there's all that going on, but at the same time, it's a very serious movie with obvious, you know, parallels to everything. But you don't feel like, oh, I get it. We need to get along with our enemy. Like, you know, you don't get cynical about it, right? Because it's told so well. And I think that's the key. And man, so again, what we're talking about here is these movies, they're so independent. They're so just unique to each other. I defy you to find a film franchise where every movie is so completely different from the other. I mean, if you look at the Rocky movies, they're all exactly the same. You know, they're all exactly the same. Yeah. And if you distill them down to the bare essentials, they're exactly the same, where you can't do that with the original series movies.
No.
All right. I mean, if you at the most base level, if you break them down, they're so different, and they just hit on every level. I mean, technically, acting, music, commentary, social commentary, you know, entertainment value. They're Star Trek at its best, And, you know, that's why I'm glad we get to talk about them here on Standard Orbit, because we're in a unique position. We get to talk about the original series. We get to talk about the original series movies. We get to talk about the Kelvin timeline movies. I love Star Trek 09. I really like Beyond. I go back and forth of which one is better. Into Darkness was kind of, you know, you're allowed one mulligan, right? So that's fine. We'll just keep giving us movies, right? Giving us movies so we get six or seven, and that way you can be like, because, you know, if Star Trek, if these movies ended at five, people would hate Star Trek V. It would be the nemesis, right, of their series. Like, oh, look, you killed the movie, Shatner! Ah! You know, the worst one's the last one. But now, you have we got Star Trek VI, and it's arguably the best one, some people argue. And it's, you know, they're right up there, right? They're all on the same level. So you can look back on this set of films and be like, yeah, you know, they did it right. They might have had a few missteps here, but what franchise doesn't? But ultimately, this is a great set of six movies. Star Trek at its best.
I can't put it better than that, I got to say, definitely. And like you said, it is what I would go to first. If I wanted to watch some Star Trek, it is what I would seek out first. Absolutely. They are awesome.
All right, Tony. Well, thanks for taking a trip down memory lane with me about these Star Trek original series films. But if people want to find you on the internet, where can they find you, man? I know you got a lot of stuff going on now with Black Hole Media, right?
Yeah, that's my overarching website/podcast network. I'm on Twitter at Black Hole Media, obviously, which is a play on my name because I'm a massive egotist, so I named my podcast network after myself. I'm the Shatner of podcast networks. yeah, you can find me there. And we've got a couple of active podcasts right now. We've got some in the vault, which can be found online. But the two active ones are the X-Cast, which is my X-Files podcast, where we're going through all the episodes. It's a huge undertaking, but we're halfway through season two, so we've got a long way to go. So if you're a fan of the X-Files, come over and check us out. We're on Twitter at the X_cast. And there's also Between the Notes, which is a film podcast, which I run with my friend and journalist, Sean Wilson, and we talk about film music, including Star Trek, in fact. We will be doing some Star Trek specific shows hopefully this year, because we're both huge fans of a lot of the music that we've touched on today. So we can find that at BT_the notes on Twitter. So look us up, look at what we're doing. It's all good stuff.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've been on the X-Cast. Brandon Shea Mitello from Melodic Treks has been on there. So we're having a lot of crossover here between us. So I'm looking forward to that. And hey, Cliff Eidelman's score for Star Trek VI, pretty good, huh?
Oh, great. Yeah, really, really good. Very different in many respects. But yeah, great.
So if you ever do a Cliff Eidelman episode, let me know. I'd be interested to hear some more of his work and see what he's up to.
Hey, well, you know, I wasn't planning it, but maybe I will now. That's not a bad idea. So yeah, I'll consider it.
There you go. All right, Tony. Well, talking about the original series films isn't the only thing we've been talking about this week on Trek FM. Here's a quick look at some other things you might have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
And basically, we had this bonding experience where basically all of us cast members were like doing jumping jacks and push-ups in between takes because we were trying not to get frostbite. And I just remember Benedict said something. He's like, I wonder if I can get a beer here while I'm, you know, like, so it's like, JJ, is there a tap I can attach to one of these and we can maybe keep warm a different way?
Literary Treks.
When it comes to these early novels, when they're written in a first season, they don't always match up well with what we learn of the characters as the series progresses. Like, for example, I think the first couple books or so, The Next Generation, there's scenes where Troy refers to Will Riker as Bill.
Melodic Treks.
So what you're saying, if I understand correctly, so let's say that there was a 2-minute piece of music and it was played in 5 different episodes. And each of those episodes had a different part that sounded the best. So you may have spliced together. Wow!
Continuing mission.
You know, we were pitching our idea, Don and I, to the folks at Starbase Studios. And I vowed to myself that I wasn't going to walk on the bridge and then go sit immediately in the chair and have a picture taken of myself. However, as soon as I got on the bridge, I sat in the chair and I took a picture of myself. So it was like a kid in a candy store.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, Speaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. If you'd like to get in touch with us here at Trek FM, you can always find us on trek.fm/contact and look in the sidebar on the show page, or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm and please leave us a voice message. You can also contact us through Twitter at trekfm and Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. And also the Babel Conference. Type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar. Another way you can help us keep all our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And speaking of Patreon, thank you as always to our associate producers of Standard Orbit, Renee Roberts, Norman Lau, Aaron Harvey, and Nick Anastasio. Thank you so much for all your support of both Standard Orbit and Trek FM through Patreon. You can find Renee on Twitter at mres_1701, Norm on Twitter at starfighter1701, and our buddy Aaron Harvey on Twitter at geekfilter. And Nick isn't on Twitter. You can find him on Facebook and, of course, around the Babel Conference. As for us personally, you can find me on Twitter at moronzach, that's M-O-O-R-E-O-N-Z-A-C-H on Twitter. And I'm also the host of my own podcast, Always Hold On to Smallville, about the Young Superman show from the early 2000s. And you can find us on Twitter at AlwaysMallville with one S. As for my regular co-host, Ken Tripp, you can find him on Twitter at BostonSCPO, so look him up on social media there. Well, that's going to do it, folks. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and join us again next time here on Trek FM for another episode of Standard Orbit.